Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Peter Kanellis, the editor of the Boston Globe's editorial page, who served as editor of the Globe's seven-part series on Mitt Romney. He joins us from Tampa, Florida, and we will discuss whether Ann Romney's well-received speech last night will improve her husband's likability factor, which is at 29% compared to Barack Obama's 51%. Then we will preview Condoleezza Rice's speech to the Republican convention with someone who worked with her in the Bush administration, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell. We will look into what a Romney foreign policy might look like, given the preponderance of neocons on his team, and what wildcards might happen in terms of overseas crises that could sway the election. Then finally, John Nichols, the Nation's magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, joins us. We will discuss the Wisconsin contingent. Governor Walker, the head of the RNC, Reince Priebus, and tonight's keynote speaker, Paul Ryan, the Republican vice presidential nominee, as well as try to determine how Paul Ryan can sell himself as a savior of Medicare, which the Ryan plan intends to cut. Joining us now from Tampa, Florida, is Peter Kanellis, the editor of the Boston Globe's editorial page. Previously, he has been the Globe's Washington bureau chief and the author of the National Perspective column since 2003. In 2007, he served as editor of the Globe's seven-part series on Mitt Romney. He also served as editor of the Globe's seven-part series on the life of Ted Kennedy and was editor of The Last Line, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Peter Kanellis.
Thank you very much.
And let's go back to yesterday, since you've been down there in Tampa. Most people seem to think that Ann Romney knocked it out of the ballpark. And I mentioned in the opening that her husband's likability factor is at 29% compared to Barack Obama's at 51%. And presumably that was her task to move the meter a bit on that. How do you think she did?
Yeah, I think she did extremely well also. She obviously is aware that people see the Romneys as being wealthy and privileged and, you know, having so many advantages that it's hard to imagine them identifying with what the average person is going through, particularly economically. But, you know, she managed to get in that when they first married, they had almost no money, and that Mitt has worked hard all his life, and that even when you have money, you have problems, and it's difficult raising the five children and tiring and disease. And, you know, she managed to humanize them through the kind of common threats that that people face: illness, economic problems, family challenges, etc.
And do you think that this film that's out now, which seems designed to also chip away at Barack Obama's likability factor, the it's called Obama 2016, paid for by some Republican deep pockets, and apparently it's I haven't seen it, but apparently it's quite a hit job, pretty much designed to make the president of the United States extremely unlikable.
Well, I've heard about that movie, too. I haven't seen it, but my sense is that that movie will play only to people who already hate Barack Obama, who are going to plunk down money just to, you know, get a really bad look at him. I don't think that will affect the mainstream. I think that's the thing about these convention speeches is it's a rare opportunity for the candidates to get beyond the base and get beyond the people who love them and hate them and speak to those who may be a little bit unsure about them. And that's why I think Ann Romney did her husband a favor last night.
So speaking of the base, what is the feeling there in Tampa in terms of who's there? My sense is, and I was reading a piece recently saying that going back 22 years ago when Pat Buchanan rocked the Republican convention in Houston and upset George Bush Sr., it seems like that the Pat Buchanan contingency is pretty much the majority today.
Well, Pat Buchanan was particularly on social issues, and he was then backed up by Marilyn Quayle, who was the wife of the vice president at that time. And, you know, they both gave speeches that are very similar to the one that Rick Santorum gave yesterday. But while Santorum was in a pretty good speaking slot, he was not in the slot that was covered by the broadcast networks and thus thereby, you know, seen by millions more people. And he was also more or less the only one. There were more people that were emphasizing economic issues than social issues. So, you know, they stuck Santorum in there to try to shore up one portion of the base, but I don't think that he was seen by enough people to really shape the convention the way Pat Buchanan did.
But if you had an applause meter, so far the biggest applause that's topped the meter so far from my cursory look at it would be the Santorum's line in reference to abortion.
Yeah, I mean, and you could see when, at least on the feed that we were watching internally, when they went and looked at the audience, you know, there were people who practically had tears in their eyes, people whose, you know, mouths were shaping in various expressions of emotion. I mean, you know, obviously that's an issue that tugs at certain people's heartstrings in a very powerful way, and they were just yelling at the top of their throat. But I don't know that. And obviously, you know, this is a sensitive issue for both parties nationally, but I don't think that Santorum by himself was able to sort of define the convention's position on that.
Again, I'm speaking with Peter Kanellis, the editor of the Boston Globe's editorial page. Previously, he had been the Globe's Washington bureau chief and the author of the National Perspective column since 2003. In 2007, he served as editor of the Globe's seven-part series on Mitt Romney, and he also served as editor of the Globe's seven-part series on the life of Ted Kennedy, and was editor of The Last Line, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. And he is in Tampa, Florida, as we speak. Now, you've done a lot of work on Mitt Romney's taxes, and that was a very, very hot story there for a while, and one which clearly Mitt Romney simply wanted off the headlines because he simply refused to deal with the substance of the story, which would have settled all of the questions, and he's refused to provide any more evidence, leading one to speculate that either he's hiding something or he's just incredibly arrogant and doesn't think the American people deserve to know about his taxes. Do you think he succeeded? Obviously, the attention's now on the convention.
Well, I mean, it depends what we don't know what is in the taxes, so you can't say whether he succeeded or failed unless you know what the alternative is. But it didn't play out well for him. I mean, I think that 29% favorability or likability rating, I think, was affected by the tax issue. I mean, you know, huge numbers of people, tens if not hundreds of millions of people, you know, now view the Romneys as extremely wealthy and privileged. And you know, part of that was all of the coverage and attention that was dwelling on those tax returns. Now, you know, if there is something that's quite, you know, problematic in the tax returns, or something that's, you know, perfectly legal but nonetheless would offend a lot of people, that he took advantage of some loophole in some way, you know, maybe it's better that he kept quiet about it. And obviously, he's living to fight another day, and he's still a very viable candidate for president. But the whole episode did not exactly play well for him, and he didn't really walk away unscathed. I think it certainly affected a lot of people's views of him.
Well, but it doesn't it indicate a certain attitude? I mean, when you say that Ann Romney and Mitt Romney are seen as being wealthy and privileged, I think that isn't that aren't they being seen fairly accurately? That's not to suggest that. They in any way are there's anything wrong with that, but it's just a fact, isn't it?
Well, it is just a fact, but obviously there are, you know, lots of facts going to who somebody is, and you know, he's also a man of faith. He's also fairly modest in his temperament. He's not an extravagant person. You know, he's somebody who is deeply knowledgeable on business issues and has been, you know, a shrewd determinant of investments in his time. You know, there are ways that the same facts could come out in a way that is more flattering to him than somebody who pays very little taxes and is so concerned about the issue that he doesn't even want to release more years of taxes because, you know, it'll so there'll be so many bones to pick through that it might damage his reputation. I think people appreciate that and are concerned about it.
Well, but on the religion aspect, do you feel that that we've learned much about it? I mean, apparently, from what you and your colleagues on the Boston Globe have done, which is where most of the reporting has come, one gets the impression that that within the world of his church, he's a sort of different person. That's when he's relaxed and humble and likable and all of those things that the likability factor that we've been talking about, that in effect he's more comfortable in that milieu, and certainly that's where most of his charity has gone through tithing, etc. So have we had an opportunity to peek inside the world that he's most comfortable in, if indeed I'm correct in that analysis?
Not yet. I mean, I think that they've sort of chosen to portray him as, you know, a devout man, a man of faith, you know, somebody who's dedicated to his church, without offering a lot of details about, you know, what it's like and what he does. Now, you referenced the Globe's reporting, which I personally can't take a lot of credit for, but over time, you know, a picture does emerge that, you know, he quietly visits Mormons who are in the hospital. He helps to settle families. He even serves as kind of a spiritual advisor for families that are in some degree of turmoil and things. And that is a very interesting, noteworthy thing, that somebody who's running for president would be comfortable playing those types of roles. But I think because the Mormons are a minority religion, a very small minority religion in this country, and because there are concerns, many of them, overblown, sort of in the mythical conspiracy theory category, particularly among some evangelical groups about Mormons. They've chosen not to go there, and it's sort of too bad. And I would tend to apportion the blame more on the people who've put out, frankly, prejudiced stories about Mormons than about the Romney preference for secrecy.
So, Peter Kanellis, again in Tampa, Florida, the editor of the Boston Globe's editorial page, and he served as editor of the Globe's 7-part series on Mitt Romney. Tonight, of course, John McCain, I think John McCain's probably speaking now, and then later Condoleezza Rice will be speaking. He sat between Condoleezza and his wife last night, Mitt Romney. And then, of course, Paul Ryan will be giving the keynote speech. We're going to be talking a little while to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell, who worked with Condoleezza Rice, about what she might be saying or what Romney foreign policy might look like. What do you think Ryan is going to do tonight?
Yeah, I think Ryan is going to try to appear to be sort of youthful and charismatic. You know, you're going to see a man kind of happily coming into his own, claiming a big prize that he probably didn't have much reason to expect a month or two ago that he would have had. The party likes and respects him in a way that they haven't yet shown to Mitt Romney. And so I expected to have sort of the air of a kind of a love fest going on in there. In terms of the message that he wants to project to the rest of the country, particularly undecided voters, I think he wants to justify their perception of him as an intellectual, as a man of ideas, as a politician of principle, and yet take the edge off of the way that his policies have been portrayed both by the Democrats but also by certain neutral parties. Try to make it seem less threatening, make his budget seem like it's a kind of common sense document and not an ideological document, put a kind of happy, optimistic face on the Romney-Ryan candidacy.
Well, Peter Kanellis, I thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Peter Kanellis, who's in Tampa, Florida. He's the editor of the Boston Globe's editorial page, and previously he's been the Globe's Washington bureau chief and the author of the National Perspective column from 2003. since 2003. In 2007, he served as editor of the Globe seven-part series on Mitt Romney. He also served as editor of the Globe seven-part series on the life of Ted Kennedy and was editor of Last Line, The Fall and Rise of Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Condoleezza Rice with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace in Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And tonight, Condoleezza Rice will be delivering a speech just before the keynote speech of Paul Ryan's at the Republican Convention in Tampa, Florida. Last night, Mitt Romney sat between his wife and Condoleezza Rice. There's no question that she's being featured fairly heavily this convention, and she's somewhat of a star, I understand, in Republican circles, particularly a recent Koch brothers fundraiser. Apparently she knocked it out of the ballpark. How do you see her influence, even though she's very adamant that she's not doesn't want a role in this administration if it's to come to be? But she, on the one hand, seems to have a lot of influence. But my understanding of most of Mitt Romney's foreign policy team is that they're basically the recycled neocons from the Bush administration.
Dr. Rice has a Chevron oil company tanker named after her. She's a perfect symbol for the corporatocracy that the Republican Party, in essence, outside the Tea Party and its extreme right wing, has come to represent. I mean, that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about the Koch brothers, Sheldon Adelson, and a host of other billionaires like them wanting Mitt Romney in office because Mitt Romney promises to let them go on with what they've been doing for the past couple of decades. And let's not just blame George W. Bush for this, because Bill Clinton sort of started it, raping and pillaging not only America, but the rest of the world with their predatory form of capitalism. I mean, that's what this is all about. Condi Rice is a perfect example of what I'm talking about.
Well, interesting, you know, in terms of oil tankers, there was a piece in yesterday's New York Times business section about how the U.S. Navy has been trying to diversify its fuel portfolio to have alternative fuel, because there's a possibility of a war in the Gulf, as we know from the Israeli press. There's a lot of talk about this, and if the Straits of Hormuz are closed and the price of oil goes up, and the Navy quite understandably is looking for alternative sources from a dependence upon gasoline. And now we learn that the Republican Congress is putting the Secretary of the Navy on the hot seat. How dare you try and give up on oil? You know, you're not the Secretary of Energy, et cetera. I mean, I find it dumbfounding that
it's incredible. We just had Ray Mabus, Secretary of the Navy, up at Boston at our conference, Collaborative Institute on Oceans, Climate, and Science conference, and some of the things he said were quite stunning. I mean, they were very commonsensical, very pragmatic, and put the Navy and DOD, by implication, at the head of all those government institutions working on things like climate change and alternative energy and so forth. So as you said, here we have the Republicans in the worship of ExxonMobil, Rex Tillerson, the CEO there, who said Kazakhstan's a better place than America, in absolute thrall to these guys who give them all their money, and whom Condi Rice, of course, as I said, represents. That's where we're going. I mean, that's what the Republican Party's challenge is to DOD now, is get off biofuel, get off alternative fuels, get off all the things you're trying to do to help us meet the future. Because let's face it, DOD has been at the spearhead of everything that's happened in this country since World War II in terms of innovation, whether we're talking the internet, stealth technology, whatever. You take DOD off this track and you take one of the most well-resourced, powerful, and self-interested, but enlightened self-interest, organizations the federal government has to throw at this problem. And it is incredible, as you just said. It's insanity.
So what do you make then, Colonel Wilkerson, of what Condoleezza Rice said on CBS's This Morning program? When she was asked what President Obama had done wrong in global affairs, she said, "There is no doubt that the United States' voice has been muted. When the United States' voice is muted, the world is a more dangerous place." I mean, I find it breathtaking, because my understanding is that the legacy of the Bush administration is, in terms of these wars, has basically been that the United States is not so much muted, but we're sort of, in many ways, a spent force.
She's right in one sense, but not the sense she meant. She's right that the arrogant, unilateralist voice of George W. Bush, Richard Cheney, and Condoleezza Rice has been muted. Thank God. If I give President Obama credit for anything, and I'm as strident a critic of him as probably anybody you will talk to, particularly with regard to his failures with respect to the financial and economic situation we're still deeply mired in, but the one thing he has done, positive thing, absolutely positive thing, is restore, somewhat at least, because George W. Bush and Dick Cheney took it down so low, our reputation in the world with regard particularly to Europe, but also with regard to Asia, Latin America, and so forth. We have restored some of the ability of the United States to influence other people, from Germany to Japan to Brazil. And that's to the credit of President Obama. So yes, he has muted the voice of arrogance and unilateralism that Condi and George and Dick brought to the White House. But that's a positive thing in my view, and I think in most Americans' view.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Now, there is a lot of talk, as I mentioned, Colonel Wilkerson, in the Israeli press about almost an inevitability that Prime Minister Netanyahu and Defense Minister Barak have made up their mind to attack Iran before the elections. I've talked to a lot of people in Israel about this and tried to get some sense out of it, because on the surface it doesn't make any sense that just as the Assads are on the rope and Hezbollah is isolated and Iran is isolated, an attack on Iran would reverse that situation, which ostensibly seems to be working in Israel's favor. What's your reading on what's going on?
I'm somewhat concerned about what you just said, but from another perspective, I believe that instead of isolating Iran, as we've been trying to do with our diplomacy and other measures over the past year or 2 years, and proof of the pudding that we haven't succeeded is the non-aligned movement being there right now with over 40 ministers, heads of state, and even the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon there, although today he used the opportunity to chide Khomeini about the nuclear program. But instead of isolating Iran, what's happened is we've isolated Netanyahu and Lieberman and Barak and others in Israel in this leadership have isolated Israel. You sit down and think about it for a moment. Whom does Israel have for a friend in the world today besides the United States? No one. Zero. This administration in Tel Aviv has made a decision that international relations, as it were, have no significance for Israel. They have said it doesn't matter what anybody else in the world thinks. That's frightening. And if there is any prospect that Netanyahu and Barak would launch a strike against Iran prior to the elections in this country in November, that is part of it because they are so isolated. We even have people self-immolating in Israel right now as a response to the austerity program that Netanyahu has implemented. Where do you see that written about in the American press? You don't. They're isolated not only domestically but internationally, and what do you do when you're isolated like that and you're, you know, somewhat off balance? You do nutty things like attack Iran, and so I am concerned that there might be an October surprise, so to speak, and we might wake up and Israel will have attacked Iran.
But it's hard to determine whether how an attack on Iran, we know it will affect the elections, and there's a great deal of suspicion that that is the intention on the part of Netanyahu, and there's a lot of understanding, I think, that there's a long relationship between Netanyahu and Romney, and we know that Adelson, the biggest donor to Romney's campaign, has devoted his fortune, if you will, to Netanyahu. But as you, as a retired U.S. Army colonel, can tell us, you know, you can't predict how these things will work out. So, if they did it before the election, who are they trying to help?
Here's the interesting thing about this. It might seem a bit counterintuitive. I think the Israelis, in terms of their leadership, and this includes Netanyahu and Barak, I think they have decided Obama's going to win, or that's the most likely outcome. What better way to ensure that they get at least a modicum of what they want and to give Obama a bounce in the polls at the last minute that might be an unbeatable one, that is, it could not be overwhelmed by Romney, by attacking Iran, and Obama has to go along with it and has to seem supportive of it, which I think if they do it before the election, he would have no choice but to be. That doesn't mean we follow up with U.S. strikes. I don't even think Israel would want that, because the retaliation from Iran will be limited if Israel is the only one who strikes. Whereas if we strike massively, the retaliation will be region-wide and against all of us. So it's an interesting question. In a political sense, it's a very opportunistic moment for Netanyahu to get what he wants, and to have the inevitability of an Obama victory, which I think they think is going to happen anyway, be more or less overcome, for the moment at least, by the fact that they've already conducted the attack, and they say, okay, what are you going to do now?
So in this little diversionary war, I assume the calculus is that Iran would not close the Straits of Hormuz. That would be an escalation that would almost guarantee the U.S. intervention.
I think so. And I think Israel would probably be dissuasive towards us with regard to any follow-up by us, even if we seem like we wanted to do it. And that's the very reason, because I think Israel simply does not have the capacity to do very much damage to Iran. Not only that, if Iran just takes it and doesn't respond in any significant way, where do you think international opinion is going to shift? I would predict it'll shift majorly towards Iran and away from us and the West in general, and certainly away from Israel, where it has already shifted majorly. So Iran comes out of a strike by Israel with no follow-up by the United States, looking pretty good and being in a better position internationally than she would be if Israel didn't strike at all. So if I were in Iran, I'd be sitting there thinking to myself, well, go ahead, Israel. We'll see what happens.
Well, but that analysis makes the whole thing even more counterproductive, counterintuitive, and somewhat insane. That's
precisely. And that's the reason I'm getting worried, because all of these insanities add up to a situation where you're painted into a corner, it all unfolds, and then you've got to figure out what to do next. The question in my mind, if a scenario like this were to develop, would be what would President Obama do in February or March or April after the intelligence community tells him, as a result of the Israeli strike, the Ayatollah has made a decision to develop a nuclear weapon? Because he hasn't made that decision now. Our intelligence community is right on that, and so is Britain's and France's and Germany's and others. They have not made a decision to weaponize. Israel attacks, we attack, regardless of who attacks, they're going to make that decision, I think. So Israel would have produced in the long run exactly what she was attacking to stop.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to United States Secretary of State Colin Powell. Well, certainly a lot to think about here. I'm sort of somewhat numb, but let's return to the convention down in Florida and the Condoleezza Rice speech tonight, followed by Paul Ryan's. I'm astounded by Romney's lack of curiosity about foreign policy. You would think that somebody that's been essentially running for president for the last 10 years would have really done some serious tutorials on foreign policy. But it doesn't appear that he has. It appears that he has a kind of corporate CEO attitude that you just outsource it. You know, you have a vice president in charge of foreign policy. Is that how he's going to run the show if he gets the nomination? I mean, if he wins the election?
He certainly worries me. A man who goes to the United Kingdom on the eve of the Olympics and tells them that he doesn't think they're ready and he doesn't think they've done as good a job as he did in Salt Lake, or by implication says that, is not a man I want conducting diplomacy and political relations for the United States. So if anything turned me off, I really had not made my decision about for whom I was going to vote in this election. I'm still a Republican. I think that performance in the United Kingdom and other things that are happening right now, and particularly with regard, as you've just mentioned, to foreign policy and security policy, are going to put me holding my nose and going into the booth and voting again for a Democrat.
And the fact that most of his foreign policy team appear to be these neoconservatives.
I've seen them before.
Right.
I've been around them before.
You've seen that
movie. I know the Boltons. I know these guys and gals. And I don't want to see him, Elliot Abrams, a convicted felon, as far as I know,
right.
Or should be. I don't want any of these people anywhere near U.S. foreign policy, and my fear is that they might be.
But in terms of holding your nose for Barack Obama, your disappointment in Obama is largely that, I take it, that he did not distance himself from the Bush administration in terms of the torture issue. He didn't follow through on his promises to close Guantanamo, and instead has inherited the kind of executive branch with the powers that Dick Cheney usurped somewhat gleefully.
There are two issues there, Ian, that spread out into many issues, but one is, as you've just said, it's his Justice Department. Yeah. Eric Holder standing up, I think it was at Northwestern University, and saying due process does not, as in the Fourth Amendment and in the Constitution, does not necessarily include judicial process, blew me off my chair. I mean, here we go, killing American citizens with due process being defined as a star chamber. That's the one issue, the Patriot Act, the FISA amendments, all of that wrapped up in that. And then the other is the economic and fiscal situation that we're in, which we really have done nothing except briefly ameliorate. Europe's getting ready to probably stick an accelerant into this process that's going to be awesome. And from everything I'm hearing from Beijing and from Shanghai, the Chinese are getting ready to collapse, too, in a real significant sense. Collapse for the Chinese means being unable to meet the 10, 11, 12% annual growth rate and going down to something more like 4 or 5. There was a wonderful op-ed in the Financial Times recently, which incidentally is about the only newspaper I read anymore. It isn't owned by some corporate guru. The Financial Times op-ed held that the criticism of Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan about Obama allowing the United States to become second in the world to China is farcical, first, because even if China's GDP surpasses ours, we're still four times richer than they are because we're one-fourth their size. And second, we better pray that China doesn't start falling off in terms of annual growth, because that's what's sustaining the world economy right now. So you throw China's relapse into Europe's failure, and we're going to have a global depression, the likes of which we've not seen in two or three centuries. And I don't see this administration even recognizing that, let alone putting in place the policies that would take care of it, or at least begin to ameliorate it.
Well, you'd think, you know, it's often been said that Angela Merkel holds Obama's fate in her hands. I'm sure that they're aware of it, but, you know, you'd think just out of pure survival they'd be thinking about it if it happens before the elections.
Yes, yes. I they must be sitting there just every night saying their prayers, and their prayers must go something like, please don't let it happen before November.
And that applies to Netanyahu as well.
Yes, exactly.
What a situation. I thank you so much for joining us, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to the United States Secretary of State, Colin Powell. In 2005, he went public with his knowledge that Vice President Cheney had provided the guidance that led to America's torture disgrace at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and elsewhere. Currently, he teaches at the College of William & Mary and George Washington University. We're going to take a brief station break, and then we'll go back to Tampa, Florida, and speak with a Wisconsinite, John Nichols, about the Wisconsin contingent, Governor Walker, the head of the RNC, Reince Priebus, and tonight's keynote speaker, Paul Ryan.
Take muskies in July. Winter's nice with all that ice and snow at Christmas time. Beer and brats are tasty, but quite apart from these, there is only one thing that we love, and that is cheese. Hey, I'm a living cheesehead that you are talking to, and cheeseheads stick together like darling, I'm with you. So if you really love me, and when you end up, please, honey, I come from Wisconsin. Give me sex or give me cheese.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Tampa, Florida, is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who is President, Dick Cheney. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's terrific to be with you, Ian.
So tonight, I guess Condoleezza Rice is going to speak about foreign policy. And then, of course, the big event, the keynote, is coming from your fellow Wisconsinite, Representative Paul Ryan, the VP nominee. You've got Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, who's a good buddy of his, as the head of the RNC. And you also, last night, Governor Scott Walker addressed the convention. What's happening to Wisconsin?
Very good question, my friend. I think the best way to put it, or the best way to explain it, is that Wisconsin is a real battleground state. It's one of the toughest battleground states in the country. And as a result, Republicans and Democrats, but particularly Republicans in recent years, have had to get really good at politics. They've had to learn how to spin the message, but also how to spend an immense amount of money and to do it in a way that wins elections. And so the simple reality of what's happened in Wisconsin is that the Republican Party has honed a lot of its messaging, a lot of its approaches over the last couple of years. And now that's coming to fruition. It's coming not just on the state stage, but on the national stage. And you're seeing it in play. Wisconsin's not the only state where this is happening. There's a handful of other states, Ohio. You know, if you took a look through an Ohio prism, you'd see Governor John Kasich as a major player, both within the party at the state and national level, but also Rob Portman, Kasich's senator, who could well have been picked for vice president if he had been you'd see, we'd all be talking about an Ohio overlay. But the bottom line is these battleground states, these places where politics is not easy. Politics is hard, and it requires, you know, a certain savvy approach. These places are becoming, you know, kind of your breeding ground, if you will, for some of your edgier politics.
So do you think it's going to be in play? Obviously, the choice of Ryan, at least the Republicans feel that it puts Wisconsin in play, and the Republicans haven't won Wisconsin since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, no, it's a it definitely has some impact, although I think you have to read it carefully and understand that that impact is not wholly definitional. Paul Ryan represented a small portion of Wisconsin, one-eighth of the state's congressional district. He was not a statewide political figure, not a particularly prominent player. And he is now, you know, being represented to the state as a national figure. So that's actually a little complicated because there are a lot of Wisconsinites, Democrats, independents, who aren't particularly happy with Mitt Romney or the Republican platform. And they won't necessarily flip over immediately to voting for Paul Ryan. The fascinating thing is that though Ryan is now on the ticket and should be having all this impact, it looks like his presence has only been worth 1 or 2 points in the polls, has not redefined the race. And the only thing that that's done is make Wisconsin competitive. It is, in some sense, a problem for Barack Obama and Joe Biden in that they now have another state they're going to have to work on. Had Ryan not been put on the ticket, Wisconsin would have been in the Obama column without much concern. And it may actually end up there, you know, once Election Day rolls around.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who's in Tampa, Florida. He is Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. And one of the reasons I think that Ryan was chosen is that he has managed to get reelected in spite of his incredibly conservative politics in a largely blue-collar working-class district in Janesville, Wisconsin, right next door to where Russ Feingold grew up. So it's all very hard for me to understand how those two politicians could cohabit, but maybe that's the history of Wisconsin, with Senator McCarthy on one side and Robert La Follette on the other. But
that's exactly right. Yeah, you nailed it. Wisconsin tends to produce major players on the right and the left, but not many major players in the middle. And so it is not at all uncommon to have a Wisconsin official who is, you know, kind of a leading figure on the right and one who is a leading figure on the left. To give you an example of it, slightly lower level politics, but when the control of the House of Representatives shifted back and forth in the early 2000s, you know, Republicans controlling then to the Democrats, then ultimately back to the Republicans. A couple of Wisconsinites, David Olby, was in charge of appropriations, the most powerful committee from a financial standpoint. James Sensenbrenner, who represents a district, you know, an hour away from Olby's, was the very right-wing chairman of the Judiciary Committee during the Clinton impeachment and then of the Science Committee during some of its real backward actions as regards global warming. So you start to see that it is a very distinctive state that produces a very distinctive politics, and that is in play on a regular basis. And it's one of the reasons why you mentioned that Wisconsin hasn't voted for a Republican for president since Ronald Reagan. You're right about that. But in many of those elections from 1988 to 2004, 2008, the Democrat only won by 8,000-10,000 votes. It was very, very close results. And so, you know, what you really end up with is a situation where, despite the fact that the Democrats have what looks like a winning record on paper, the reality is that it's usually a very competitive state.
Well, it's obvious that the Republicans have an extremely arbitrary and casual relationship with the truth. And their campaign, all of their ads are just flagrant lies. And it's pretty hard to believe that Ryan, with a straight face, is running to save Medicare when the Ryan budget will eviscerate Medicare. So I'm just wondering, though, whether the fact that he seems to be able, at least in his district, appeal to the blue-collar Reagan Democrats. Do you expect that to be the thrust of his speech tonight, and I'm just a regular guy? Because the last speech I saw him give in Janesville, he was referring to some of his buddies that had been out of work. You know, I mean, this is a guy...
No, you got it. Yeah, and that's exactly right. That he's going to try and fancy himself a kind of a relatively blue-collar, Irish Catholic, Reagan Democrat kind of guy. The only problem with that is it's a complete scorching lie. You know, he's never been blue-collar. His family is multi-generational, very wealthy, millionaires. To give you an example, his family has been rich longer than Mitt Romney's family has been rich. And Paul Ryan has been a Republican insider all of his life, his way up paved by family, friends, and political allies at every turn. And in fact, it's funny, I was with his mom an hour ago at a fundraising event. I've known the Ryan family for many, many years. And, you know, this is a wealthy, you know, kind of an elite family that fit into a certain mold. They weren't jerks about it. They, you know, they were of the community. They gave back to the community, but they lived in the house on the top of the hill. And when Paul Ryan went to Congress, he did not go to Congress as some sort of, you know, paleo-conservative budget balancer. That's not who Paul Ryan is. Paul Ryan is a Chamber of Commerce Republican of the old school who believes in using the power of government to restructure rules, regulations, laws to favor business and to favor wealthy people. That's what he has always done. It's what he will do as a politician. He got away with it in Wisconsin in part because of a fantasy. This notion that his district is a blue-collar district, that's true, but it also has on its northern tier all the Milwaukee suburbs. And so the blue-collar union workers were invariably outvoted by the suburban workers. And when you start to understand it in that way, you realize that this is not, you know, this is not a guy who was winning, you know, over union members necessarily. He might have gotten some of them in an off year when there wasn't a very strong Democratic candidate. But by and large, he was winning with the classic Republican suburban and small town votes. And I'm not sure that he will translate well into a state like Ohio or Pennsylvania, where you have a lot of blue collar workers. Certainly that is the hope, that is the dream of the Republican machine at this point. They desperately want that to work. But I, you know, you and I talk a lot about media, Ian, and you've done such good work on it in so many ways over the years. And I think you understand that this is really going to be a test for media. If a minimally accurate portrayal of Paul Ryan and his policies is revealed to the American people, he will lose. I mean, he will actually bring the ticket down. He will be damaging to the Republican ticket. On the other hand, if he can get the media to buy into a pure fantasy of him as, you know, some kind of working class kid, then, you know, that's a much more problematic situation, and one that, you know, again, it won't be Paul Ryan winning. It will be the media making it possible for a candidate who, you know, is in no way in tune with union members and blue-collar workers to fool them again.
So, John Nichols, since you're down there in Tampa, just give us a flavor of what you've seen so far. we've had, you know, of course, last night you had Ann Romney humanizing her husband, and for all of the reviews have been pretty glowing about her speech. And then, of course, you had Chris Christie. The humorist Andy Borowitz has an article out in his faux news articles saying a deranged man slipped through security at the Republican National Convention and managed to make a keynote speech. I mean, he did seem like he might explode at any moment. And
it was a ridiculous. It was one of the most uniquely dysfunctional keynote addresses in the modern history of politics. It played reasonably well with a certain group of people in the Republican Party, but no one in their right mind could have tuned into that and said, oh yeah, I'm really comfortable with this. You know, I want this as my option. And it was especially absurd because he appeared right after Ann Romney. So Ann Romney gets up there and talks about love, about, you know, the power of love and things like that. And then, you know, here you have Governor of New Jersey get up and say, well, it can't be about love. It's got to be about respect. Forget about love. You know, that's loser stuff. That's bad stuff. Well, come on. With all due respect, this country has never, ever wanted leaders to tell it tough stuff. America has never said, yeah, give us every, you know, bit of tough information. We just deal with what we have to deal with. No, America is a land of hope, right? And the one thing that united Ronald Reagan's candidacy in 1980 and Barack Obama's in 2008 is that they both had as their default term hope. You know, they both offered a notion that things are going to get better under them. To have somebody like Chris Christie get up there and tell them, no, it's going to be pretty awful, and, you know, you're not going to love us, but you'll respect us for, you know, cutting your arm off. No, probably one of the worst messages you could possibly deliver from a pure political standpoint.
Well, but it was also somewhat deranged, but not necessarily, that doesn't mean it wouldn't be appreciated by Republicans, because a lot of them are living in a very comfortable delusion about what the party stands for, in the sense that he was saying that we will bring free enterprise and market solutions. Meanwhile, the other side, the Obama people, they just want to coddle you. Now, the notion that the United States government coddles American citizens is so absurd, given what little social services exist in this country, and that those that do, Medicare and Social Security, are both under attack by the Republicans who want to eviscerate them. The only people that the U.S. government coddles are the military-industrial complex corporations, agribusiness corporations, etc. It is just an absurd notion. But yet, Obviously, you have to assume that kind of ridiculous stuff resonates.
Yeah, but, you know, I got to tell you, I'm not even sure how well it resonates with the Republican Party. I agree with you. It resonates with a certain portion, you know, a tiny portion of talk radio listeners. You know, if you can imagine this, if it's possible, overly intellectualized right-wing budget hawks. Maybe that plays well with, because they've bought into a fantasy and think of it as some sort of deep, you know, well-thought theory about how we're going to save the country by, you know, essentially gutting out government at every level. And to them, maybe this makes sense. But that is a tiny portion even of the Republican electorate. You know, you think of the Ron Paul backers, and Ron Paul backers who really had a hard time at the convention the other day, very badly treated by the leadership of the party, so much so that Ron Paul is not going to support Romney for president. And yet the Ron Paul backers, you know, they're very anti-government. I mean, really down on it. But if you go to a rally, what they talk about is getting rid of government and creating actually a very attractive circumstance. Now, you and I might really disagree. We might argue with them at every point and say, this is just ridiculous. It's not going to turn out that way. But they don't deal in, you know, horrible austerity and deep cuts. They say, well, you get government off your back and everything's going to be great. Christie actually got up there and basically said, it's going to be bad. It's going to be ugly. That is not, it's not going to get you elected. And that is why the bottom line is that the mood in Tampa is one of, everybody wants to talk about Ann Romney's speech. He's a Republican. Nobody wants to talk about Chris Christie's speech.
So
they may agree with it, some of them, but they get it. It was a bad, bad message.
But isn't that the central message, though? Isn't that why they have that debt clock featuring it so prominently? The idea that this is all about deficits, and somehow this irresponsible government has run up the debt. And if you, using the family checkbook analogy, you can't live beyond your means. It's all very simplistic stuff, but presumably that's what they're trying to sell.
Absolutely, it is. There's no doubt about it. But it doesn't mean that they're stupid enough to think it's actually appealing. You know, what they're going to do, here's what they want. They want to have a feel-good argument for austerity. And you and I know, especially from dealing with the European experience, that austerity is brutal. It is a horrible, horrible, and fully dysfunctional approach to creating a civil society. And it is invariably used to redistribute the wealth from poor and working class people upward to the very, very rich, even in a difficult economic time. And so, you know, I mean, the arguments against austerity are so strong, so, you know, logical, that they're a very hard sell. And yet, that's what they're going to try and do. They know they can't sell it realistically to say, well, you know, we just bailed out the banks. We bailed out a lot of, you know, big industries. Now we are, you know, paying for wars that we put on credit cards and all that. And so you need to suffer because we did all this stuff for the military-industrial complex and Wall Street. And, you know, the American people would logically say that's crazy. And, you know, we want rich people to pay a little more in taxes. Polling shows overwhelmingly that is the favored position. We want corporations to pull their load. And if they don't, we want to regulate them and hold them to account. That's what the American people want. So the Republicans have to sell a fantasy that we are in a crisis so severe that we can't do that because those guys might leave or those guys might do something else. And so you, the citizens, have to take all the burden. It's a ridiculous, dysfunctional fantasy. And the only way you could possibly sell it is to make people feel like it's a happy, positive thing. And that's what Paul Ryan's job is tonight. And can I tell you, Ian, it's a hard task. I do not envy what Paul Ryan has to try and communicate. He may pull it off. I don't know. Ronald Reagan pulled off some incredible fantasies. But I'm going to tell you, convincing the American people that it is in their interest to pay off the unbelievable debts run up on behalf of the military-industrial complex in Wall Street, I mean, that's a tough sell.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Tampa, Florida.
It's great to be with you, Ian. And I must say, I do a lot of interviews. It's always good to be on with you and get into some of the deeper issues.
Well, thanks again, John.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is in Tampa, Florida. He's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent, and he's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who Is President, Dick Cheney. Again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Headline written down.